LA Tuesday and Wednesday with a high near 80 degrees, about 78, 79. And then Thursday, a chance of showers, partly sunny, though, a high of 74. Same forecast for Friday with a high of just about 69 degrees. We currently have 65 right now in downtown Butler at 1230. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Tier Bank studios. Next Tier Bank, your hometown community bank. Always get news on our website, butlerradio.com, and on Alexa-powered devices. You just download the Butler Radio News skill and then say, Alexa, what's in the news? Thanks for joining us. Dave Malark is up next with It's Your Turn. Have a good day.
And now, It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's Your Turn. Weekdays from 1230 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's Your Turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Monday edition of It's Your Turn. Ordinarily, eh, boy, Monday, where did the weekend go? But today, Howie Pettney is here, so that makes Monday a lot more cheerful. How's that for an intro, Mr. Pettney?
That's unbelievable. Listen, aren't you celebrating like 60 or 70 years of being here or something like that?
Well, it's not quite that long, but it's quite a while, yeah.
And what is it? Is it 40?
It's in that neighborhood. Yes, it is 40.
It is 40. Yes. Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I can't believe that I've been listening to you for 40 years. And I probably haven't because I've only lived in Butler County since 1990. Yeah. So I've been listening to you for a few years anyway.
Well, it's good to see you today. Howie Pentany is with the Pentany Capital Management in Portersville, and he visits with us. We're taking a look. It's three-quarters of the way through the year, believe it or not, as of yesterday. We have just one quarter to go, October, November, December. So we're taking a look at the markets, at investments, how investments did. By the way, we give no specific advice here on this program. For that, you should turn to your wealth manager, your tax accountant, your attorney. Our information is general and educational, but no specific advice, of course. And we always mention that anytime we're talking with a professional person here on the program, and we talk to a lot of them. So that aside, I would have to think, I don't know, from a layperson's point of view, we haven't been breaking any records, but investments seem to have been pretty solid so far, but a good year, hasn't it? Three-fourths of the way through?
We could just shut it down right here and it'd be okay. You know, it's, I mean, seriously, you know, yeah. The market has averaged someplace, depending on, you know, where you want to look, 9% return over a long period of time. And, you know, right now, the S&P is up 12 and change. Standard & Poor's 500 is up 12.3 or something. So, you know, relative to other years or the average year, if you will, this has been okay. It's getting, you know, it's like watching paint dry now because we just haven't done anything for a while. And, you know, interestingly enough, the averages have been hitting records, but generally only by, you know, very small point each day.
If they go up. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 12, 15, 20. Yeah. We have set any number of benchmark record highs, yeah. But we've never, you know, it's not by going up 400 points or something like that, which in today's market really is still a rather small percentage. It's not like the olden days.
Well, you see, you know, you could see a lot of things happen. I mean, it's very unusual to see markets just not do anything like they're doing right now. And typically that leads to something, either a downdraft or an updraft. And depending on who you want to listen to, why, you know, you can get any sort of what's going to happen next, you know, that kind of stuff, which is why we don't do that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have some people who say that, one of these days we're going to have a melt up, which means that the Dow could go up, you know, 500 or 1,000 points in one day. And then there are people who say we're going to have a meltdown, so the same thing could happen. So I don't worry about that stuff. I mean, I think people who do shouldn't be investors. You know, you should be, you should have yourself positioned where you're comfortable. And, you know, when I, if I talk to a new investor and they're all, you know, they just don't, they don't have a clue what they're doing. And there are a lot of those people out there today because we're all getting older. And there's like 9,000 people a day turning 65 for the next 10, 12, 14 years. And it's already started, you know. There's a lot of people out there who have their retirement accounts and so on, but they've really never dealt with the investment side of it, you know. They've just done whatever somebody told them to do, and they do it. And so, you know, you don't have a clue. So you get out of that situation, all of a sudden, you have to take money out of your savings. See, people are, you know, many people in our country here in the United States are really good savers, Dave. I mean, you tell them what they need to save and they'll save it. However, when it comes time to take that money back, they don't know how to do it. You know, if they've saved and they have $250,000 in a 401k, for instance, well, how do I get that money out of there? I was really comfortable putting it in, but now I got to take it out. And that's all there is. You know, I'm not going to put any more money in.
And there are governmental regulations that require you to withdraw at a certain age or a certain time, right?
Right. As you get to be around 70, you know, 70 and a half, actually, an IRA, if you have an IRA account, you have to take money out based on your life expectancy, according to the IRS tables generally. And, you know, but people, it doesn't help any because people don't know, you know, how much money can I have? That's their question. That's good. How much money can I have? If I, you know, if we invest this much money, how much money can I have? They don't have a clue. And it's very difficult, you know, to help them to understand that you're taking, when you take money out of your savings, and they're in, and we're going to assume they're invested, okay, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, whatever. You know, you're taking money out of dividends and capital gains. And capital gains. What you hope to do in a perfect world is make enough dividends and capital gains to more than cover your withdrawal. So let's assume, for instance, that the stock market goes up 7% and you get 2% in dividends. Okay, so that's 9. So you pay some expenses of a couple, so you're back to 7. And so how much can I take? Well, one of the accepted numbers today, which, you know, arguably could be anything, is 4%. Many years ago, it used to be 6. I can remember it when people would say, how much money can I have? And I'd say 6%. And so now a lot of people say 4. So if you have $250,000 times 4%, there's your number. Okay? So, you know, you've got to adjust to that. I mean, if your pension is 25% or 30% of your salary, something's got to give. You need to adjust that somehow. And a lot of people do it. I mean, it's not unusual.
You adjust that every year, annually?
You should. Yeah, you should. Yeah, if it's a perfect world, you should. How much money did I make this year? Did I make anything? Mm-hmm. If I lost money, I need to adjust it downward. So if you're doing it right, that's what you should do. I would venture to guess that most people don't do that. If their number, if they got $250,000 times 4% is $10,000, they just keep it at $10,000. Now, they may actually raise it after a while. If the market continues to grow and all of a sudden that 250 is 300, then they want 4%, that's 12,000. So they raise it to 12. So, you know, the big deal today, I think, is health care. What's it going to cost to take care of yourself from a health care standpoint? And, you know, I saw an article in Consumers Reports the other day, which basically said, who's going to take care of you, you know, when you retire and as you get older? I've seen all kinds of funny things. Like, I think one of the best things I saw put together by an investment company was a question asked by a retiree. And the question was, who's going to bring me my ice cream? Now, that's a pretty funny question, isn't it? But if you can't get out to get it, right? Who's going to bring it to you? Another question was, who am I going to go to lunch with? Because guess what happens? You get older, people die. Okay? And maybe you don't have anybody to go to lunch with now.
I've heard of people that are in that situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of things that happen, you know. And nobody ever really thinks about it in that way. But, man, that's the way it is. Who's gonna bring me food? Who's gonna take me to lunch?
When do people, or is there a best time of the year to start taking a look at this? If you want to review it on an annual basis,
I don't think so, Dave. I don't have any particular. I do it generally speaking. If you have a time of the year that you have a review with your investment person, that's probably a good time to do it. You know, if you review it in June, then review it in June. But you definitely should do it. Where am I? You know, last time I was here, you and I talked about knowing what you own. You know, it's a good time to talk to your investment person about what is it I own? What is this that I own? I've actually asked that question to people. What is this? I don't have a clue. I mean, it's unbelievable. People don't know what they own, and they need to know what is it I own and what are my risks. You know, a lot of people think that bonds have no risk. You know, they pay a certain interest rate, they mature, blah, 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 blah. Well, that's not accurate. Sometimes, at a couple of points in my career, I've seen the bond market lose as much as a stock market sometimes. I mean, I've seen bond markets down 20%. So, you know, that's something you need to look at. You need to know what you own and, you know, what's going to happen if this happens. If interest rates go up from basically zero now to 10%, what's going to happen? And you need to know that kind of thing. There's no exact answer, you know, nothing. We don't have any substance here on this show, so there's no exact.
No, but you need these things, and people forget that there are, for example, as you were talking just a few minutes ago, there are government mandates about you have to start withdrawing from savings when you reach a certain age. I assume that's not a date certain, but sometime in that calendar year, I would imagine. But these are the things you have to find out.
Right, right. And it's you have to do it when you're 70 and a half, and you know, you don't want to typically do it twice in the same year if you got to do it every year because then you get a higher tax bill. So, you know, your most financial people can explain that to you relatively easy about what you're doing. And most investment companies actually tell you, you know, they tell you, hey, this year, Dave, you got to take $10,000 out of your account. Then you can plan. Well, now I'm going to need $15,000 to live on, so maybe I take the 10 and 5 and there we go. See, and you can do that. See, that gives you an opportunity to plan a little bit, you know, the mandatory. Now, why do they make you take money?
That's a good question.
Because you haven't paid any taxes on it.
And they want to make sure they get the taxes from you.
If you've put $100,000 in a 401k and now it's $250,000, you made all that money and haven't paid any taxes. Uncle Sam doesn't like that. You know, so you have to take it out and pay taxes on it. And if you do it right, you know, most people, if they're fortunate enough to have enough money, Dave, you know, they take that money and just, they don't spend it. They take their withdrawal and they put it in another account and they use it to live off of as they go along. You know, a lot of people do that. If they're fortunate, it depends on how much money you have. Some people are fortunate, some aren't. Depends on, you know, how successful you were. But That's the scare. That's the thing that I see if I happen to meet with investors who don't, who they've been investors and they've been saving, but they really didn't have a clue what they were doing. Typically, they are concerned, how do I get my money out of here? And how do I not run out of money? That's the big deal, of course. You don't want to run out of money. Unless you have wealthy children who can take care of you, you know. But that you probably don't want to count on that. But, you know, that's the deal. How can I how much money can I take out, max, and not run out of money?
Somebody asked, because in fact, you're going to be chatting with us today, of course, and somebody said, well, ask Howie about how the tax reform proposal by President Trump is going to affect investors. I said, well, you have to realize that made headlines a week or so ago, but it is probably nowhere near the final form that it's going to be. It was a wish list. It was like a State of the Union message. It's going to be adjusted. The Senate and the House are going to work on it, and who knows what final form it's going to be. And then somebody said, well, yeah, but they're going to eliminate the estate tax. I said, well, wait and see. You never know what the final bill is going to be.
Well, you tell that person that the only thing Howie knows is he hopes it favorably affects him. You know, but and that's what everybody – see.
It's what everybody hopes.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. And if you look at, you know, everything in the – I don't want to say you can't believe the press. You can't rely on the press because the press – everything's negative. So – you know, I saw a headline yesterday about the tax reform only benefits the top 1%. That was the headline. Okay, so I'm like you. I just don't pay any attention. People say, well, what do you think? I say, well, I tell you what, when it gets enacted, come and ask me the question.
Absolutely. Okay? Then you'll be able to give an answer.
Yeah, because then I can give an answer. But right now, I'm not even going to speculate it because politicians being politicians, who knows what, if anything, we get in tax reform. I mean, there are no guarantees. It's not written anyplace that we're going to have tax reform, you know. And the way the Democrats and the Republicans are, you know, not working together, I mean, theoretically, it could never get done, theoretically. But, you know, it's likely that something will happen, but as to who it affects, tell me what's going on after it's passed, and I'll tell you.
Well, I'm glad I responded in that way then, but we've seen it before in any number of other areas where there's big headlines about, and I'm not
proposed.
Yeah, I'm certainly
that's
not
the word, Dave.
Certainly not picking on Trump here, but that presidents propose, governors propose,
right.
Lawmakers adjust, work on it. Dicker horse trade, and who knows what comes out of the other.
As soon as I see proposal in the story, I stop reading the story. Seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this has been proposed, blah, blah. I don't care what's proposed. I want to know what it is. And they'll eventually get around to it, I suspect. But, you know, the Democrats typically want a tax, and the Republicans typically might want to spend. I don't think there's any question. You know, that's the perception people have. So, you know, my view has been over the long period of time that it hasn't necessarily been a bad thing to have lower taxes, you know. But if you remember, and since I know you were alive back then, since you're old like me, you know, back in the 70s, there was a 50% tax bracket. I think the early 70s, there was a 50% tax bracket to the highest ordinary income wage earners. Right now, it's probably 38 or 40 or something. So, you know, it's better than it used to be. But I think that as many people want it, they want to keep the favorites, Dave. I want to keep my mortgage deduction.
Don't touch that.
You know, don't touch the, you know, blah, 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 blah. And they want to, you know, they want to do that.
And there are lobbying groups already. The realtors have already come out and said, because Trump proposed eliminating the mortgage deduction, they say, well, you can't do that. Wait a minute. You can't do it. So, again, wait till it's enacted into law, if it's enacted into law, and then we can talk about what it might mean. Something else the federal government does is they regulate interest rates, and the Fed has been pushing them up just a touch here and there, right? I mean, they're not going up like gangbusters, but they're up a little bit.
And they depending on the way you look at it, Dave, fortunately or unfortunately, if you look at a 10-year treasury, for instance, around 2% plus, that still is not something that people who invest in that type of an instrument consider to be a nice interest rate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you go back a long while, you can remember money market funds were 6 or 7%, you know.
Sometimes 10 plus a toaster.
Yeah, exactly. So, so these rates today are very difficult on people like that. People who do not want to take risk and who just want to buy fixed income, certificates of deposit or other things, you know. And, with interest rates so low, it's very difficult to get a good return. That's why many people rely on the stock market for dividends and capital gains, assuming that works.
I saw a headline on a wire story just last week. Is your bank account actually losing money? Well, for many people it is, quite frankly. Depending on what you have, if you have any money invested in some of those instruments, CDs, T-bills, treasuries.
It's difficult. If you're getting 1.25%, for instance, after you pay your taxes and after inflation, it's very difficult to walk away from the table with anything. You know, if you get a half or something, maybe that's good. But once you factor in inflation, once you factor in the taxes on your investment return, it's very difficult to walk away with anything these days because rates are just so short. And you look at the 10-year, people used to look at the 30-year treasury now everybody looks at the 10. Well, the 10's 2 plus whatever it is. I haven't seen it today. But I think it's about 2.4%. That's to your point. That's up. The yield is up. But, it's been staying around 2%. So I think the 3-year is about 2.4. The 10-year is still about 2%. The 3-year is about 2.4%. So, you know, that sort of an arrangement, is it doesn't make you any money. And, it's just difficult to be in that market and get your income that you need.
You're tying up your money for a long time, too.
Yeah, and then if you have to sell it, it's worth what it's worth. Mm-hmm. So, and if it's not worth what you paid for it, then obviously there's a loss involved. But it should. I'm not negative on fixed income. I mean, I think fixed income is a good hedge. In other words, that's where I think you fix it today. Is, you know, it's good to help you control your risk. You know, if you have 70% of your money in the stock market and 30% in bonds, then you have probably, you know, cut down the risk a little bit. And a lot of people do that. That's called asset allocation. A lot of people do that. Not uncommon. Well, I'm not, you know, I really don't want to risk 100% of my money, you know. So maybe I'll risk 60 or 70%, something. Well, you know, if that's what you do, that's what you do. And you just have to, as I say, you have to take the consequences. If the market goes up 10% in the bond, and you have 60% of your money in the stock market, 40% in bonds, and bonds don't return anything or they pay your expenses of investment, and you make a 7% return on 70% of your money, that's 4.9% on your whole portfolio. So, you know, whatever you do to protect yourself, you also have to give it up on the upside. Same thing if the market goes up 7%, you only make 4.9. So, you know, you just have to be someplace comfortable, and everybody has to do the right thing. And there is no right place for everybody. I mean, I have clients who are even older than you and I, or older than me, I guess. And they take you know, they may have 100% in the stock market. You know, there's a lot of people that don't, but I have some clients who are older and they just buy stocks that pay dividends and then and whatever happens, happens. So people do different things, you know, depending on the comfort. And I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's good to be aggressive all the time. So, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with shutting it down a little bit. So, you know, when you get to be like us, you know, our goals are not to lose a lot of money, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we'd like to make some money.
And want it to be there whenever we need it.
Exactly. But I would prefer not to lose a lot of money. So if you prefer not to lose a lot of money, you have to do other stuff.
We'll take a quick break. We're chatting with Howie Penteny today from Penteny Capital Management in Portersville. And we'll take a break and pick up our conversation in just a few moments. By the way, later on the program today, Matthew Kramer. He's the musical director and conductor of the Butler Symphony. All of our cultural groups are, and we're really blessed here in the Butler area to have so many. They're starting up. Most of them take a few months off during the summertime. The Butler Little Theater just reopened its... just opened its 77th season this past weekend with the production of Neil Simon's Biloxi Blues. By the way, that continues tomorrow night through Saturday at the Butler Little Theater. The Musical Theater Guild will soon open its new season, and they're going to be doing Beauty and the Beast in a couple of weeks. We'll be chatting with guests from that group in a few days. And the Symphony, the Butler Symphony Association, will be kicking off its new season early this month, and we'll talk about it with Matthew Kramer today. The new season actually opens this Saturday at Butler Intermediate High School, so Matthew will join us. One of our sponsors on the program today is Goin' Postal. Have you heard about this business, Goin' Postal? It's your friendly neighborhood shipping center here in Butler, Goin' Postal Butler. They're just off Newcastle Road. They're right behind King's and Villa Grande. You know, those two restaurants are side by side there. Right behind them in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex, you'll find Goin' Postal Butler. So what do they do? Well, the name says it all. It's your friendly neighborhood shipping center. They will package your items for shipping, which is a real burden many times. Sometimes just one package. Sometimes if you got several, man, boxes, shipping tape, labels, yada, yada, yada. They do all that for you. And you can ship it any way you want. FedEx, UPS, U.S. Postal Service, your choice. They have other services as well at Goin' Postal Butler. Copying, scanning, faxing, mailbox rentals, greeting cards, even an official notary. Sometimes you need that if you're mailing out a document. Oh, and you can pick up a lottery ticket there, too. Goin' Postal Butler. Here's phone number. You can call him for more information. 724-841-0044. 724-841-0044. Your neighborhood-friendly shipping center, Goin' Postal Butler, just off Newcastle Road behind the King's and Villa Grande. We're talking with Howie Penteny from Penteny Capital Management here today. And we're taking a look back at the first three quarters of the year, believe it or not, which have passed as of yesterday.
You want to do the numbers?
Yeah, I was going to ask you because we kind of talked around.
Well, that's what everybody wants. Yeah, they don't want to listen to us. They want to listen to the numbers.
We didn't actually give the numbers. Right?
And these numbers are not including dividends, which I like, because everybody has expenses. See, I mean, if you have money, if you have investments, there are expenses. So these numbers are as a matter of fact, from the Wall Street Journal, and so these don't include dividends. So the Dow, which nobody pays much attention to anymore because it's only 30 stocks, is up 13.4.
So 13% since the beginning of the year, yeah.
That's correct. And then the total stock, if you look at everything in the stock market, large cap, small cap, whatever, the total market's up 12.3, which, interestingly enough, is just where the Standard & Poor's 500 is. So the S&P 500's up 12.5. The total market's up 12.3. Now, what does that tell you? It tells you that the small and mid-cap stocks are not doing as well as the market, for instance. And this is very unusual. Usually when I'm in here, if the markets are doing well, they're being led by the small caps and the mid caps, because that's where all the growth is generally, you know. And for instance, this year, the Russell 2000, which is basically the small caps, small company index, is up 9.9. It's really, this is about the best it's been all year. It's up 9.9. So the S&P, the big stocks, are up 12.5. The small stocks are only up 9.9. So that's unusual. And the mid-cap index, which is the mid-cap 400, is up 8.2. So those are holding down the market. See, if they were doing as well as the market, then the total numbers would be a lot bigger. So they're just kind of holding things down a little bit, which is kind of unusual and interesting.
On the other hand, though, if you're sitting there with, you know, money tied up in, I don't know whether anybody still has CDs, or, and you're looking at the paltry interest rate, you're earning 8%, 9%, 12.5%. Boy, that sounds pretty good.
Right.
That sounds really good.
Right. Well, the NASDAQ has been full of excitement this year because of, you know, stocks that have been leading the way, generally speaking, have been in the NASDAQ. And I have an interesting thought about that, by the way. But the NASDAQ's up almost 21. So the over-the-counter market's up about 21. So that's a big number. Now, that's being influenced by a few stocks. Just a few stocks are helping to push it up there. However, if you look at the S&P 500, unweighted, equally weighted, in other words, the Standard & Poor's 500 is a market capitalization index, which means that if you have a big company, it carries more weight in there, okay, when they're figuring the index, okay? Mm-hmm. So if your stock's worth a lot of money, like a Google or something, you know, in the S&P 500, they carry a lot more weight. And the one I love the most is the unweighted S&P 500, which assumes that you had 500 stocks and you owned the same amount in all of them, okay? That index has also been hitting new records. Hmm. How about that?
I wasn't even aware of that index. I never heard of that before.
Well, nobody uses it. You have to buy it in an index, like an exchange-traded fund, an ETF, okay? Because not too many people have used it. Now, it's become more popular over the years, I think, because it's done pretty well.
But you don't see it in the...
No, you don't see it. There's no...
online, you know, or a newspaper
or anything.
Right. Yeah?
Okay. Somebody built it.
Okay.
Okay, somebody built it. And that's the reason they built it. Because people like me like it. I like that index, and I would like to be able to buy it, and you can now because it's equally weighted. And I like that because the other way, if one stock does poorly, that can negatively affect the return. I'd rather have equally weighted. And there's a lot of these indexes out there that people have invented that you can participate in now if you want to. The problem of this whole thing, in my view, in my opinion, I've been around for a long time. In my opinion, investors have never been better off than they are today. They have a myriad of financial instruments available to them. It's incredible. I mean, I've been around for a long time. There's stuff out there that I don't know about. Okay. So if you want to build a portfolio, you can probably find a way. You know, if you want to have small cap, mid cap, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's a way you can build that account. So it's kind of interesting, but it's confusing for the average investor. What is this? You know, it's back to our question. What is it that you own? You know, what is this? And so they don't know what to do about it. It's very confusing, in my opinion. And that's why, again, in my opinion, that you need professional help from somebody who knows what they're talking about. You know, there are lots of different kinds of investment people out there. You know, they got different names, investment advisors, and they've got investment managers and financial advisors, and there's all kinds of names of things. And what the investor needs to do today is figure out what he needs. Do I need a financial advisor to help me with my overall finances? Do I need someone to manage my, what is it that I need, see? And there's probably out there someplace is probably someone that would fit what you need. But you have to look around. Again, somewhat confusing in my view. Because people might think that a good financial advisor is a good manager of investments, and that may or may not be true. Mm-hmm. You know, it depends. So you need to, I think you need to shop around. You know, I tell everybody, you need to go out and shop around and see who makes sense to you without getting a sales job. You have to remember something. People like me are professional salesmen. So you have to make sure that you're not being sold. And you have to make sure that these people are telling you what you want to hear by way of whether or not they know what they're talking about. See, that it's all very difficult. And I just think that there, again, I think investors are better off today than they've ever been. And I think that there's somebody out there that can help you.
You mentioned that NASDAQ it's up more than any of the other indexes, right?
Yeah, it's 20. Yeah.
20? Is NASDAQ still primarily what we would call high-tech, cutting-edge companies, or no?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I mean, if you're looking at Facebook and Google and and Netflix and those kinds of companies, that's where they're located.
They're on the NASDAQ exchange.
Yeah. And so the NASDAQ used to be the over-the-counter market. It used to be, generally speaking, and I don't think I would be exaggerating, but it used to be like junk companies. You know, maybe companies that did not qualify to list on the New York Stock Exchange. So they'd go over and they'd trade their stock on the NASDAQ. But the whole thing's changed now. You know, that doesn't really mean anything.
The just a couple of, while we're talking about those stocks, Apple just unveiled they unveiled two models of iPhone, which I think took people by surprise. There's an iPhone 8. Which is instantly available, the latest reiteration of their smartphone. They skipped 9 for some reason, I don't know. And then there's an iPhone 10, which supposedly they're about to get ready to take orders for, even though it's not going to be delivered until December. And now, I just heard at the end of last week, all kind of production delays, and they may not be taking orders for a while. And there's some kind of a potential problem with the face recognition. Well, it's the parts that they need for the face recognition to unlock your phone that they're having trouble with. Anyway,
here's the problem, Dave.
Yeah, okay.
These phones are all smarter than I am. See, that's the problem. So, I mean, I just got a newer version of a phone. Okay, and it does things that I don't need to do. Most of the things it does, I don't need to do. The cameras on these things are as good or better than professionals use. And many of them, the phone that I have, a professional is supposed to be able to use as his camera. Okay, I mean, it does all kinds of stuff that I don't. I mean, I get in there and start hitting it around, and pretty soon I want to slap it, because I need it to go back where it was.
I think most people don't use all of the capability of their smartphone, and you're right, they get smarter all the time. And Apple, they're one of the big two. Samsung obviously is the other one, but there are other companies, by the way, that make smartphones.
Sure.
LG, Motorola, and others, but Apple and Samsung are the big two. And Apple does a heck of a job in convincing people that they need the latest iPhone.
Well, they have been. And what you're saying is they have been marketing geniuses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like I always laugh at it because every week they come out with a new announcement that hits the press, and the press
eats it up.
Eats it up, man. Apple's got this new phone, and we're going to tell you about it. They are good marketers.
I've heard some people say, well, iPhone 8 is really not all that much different from the iPhone 7.
Right.
But, they've created this desire in people that you want to have the latest, if you're an Apple person, you want to have the latest one.
And that's pretty much, not to pick on Apple or anyone, that's pretty much the case across technology. I mean, computers, I used to have a laptop that was so heavy that it would cause me to be overweight at the airport. A laptop, okay? You know, it weighed 13 pounds or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was crazy, okay? Now you can get them so that they're, if you want to use a pad, you can use a pad. But I happen to use a small laptop. And it's the coolest thing because it fits in my backpack. I can throw it in my backpack. And it only weighs, I don't know if it weighs 2 pounds or not, but, you know, you can get things today that make your life easier, that that do the same thing or more. I mean, the computer that I have does a lot more than my 13-pound one that I used to have. So this thing's a little tiny thing. And, you know, I can just travel. If I don't care where I am, I can use it all over the world. So it's really cool that those things are available. And they've gotten smaller, faster. You know, everything good has happened.
They're also getting a lot more expensive. And that's the big question. The iPhone 10 is $1,000. And there are a lot of people saying, well, wait a minute. I've got an iPhone 5 or 6 or 7 that works perfectly well. Why would I want to spend $999 for...
And they're going to finance it.
Yeah. And then I saw another article on The Wire last week. It was fascinating. And this was a... He wasn't a futurist, but he was saying, you know, in 10, 12, maybe 15 years, smartphones are going to be obsolete. You know, nobody's going to carry that around in your pocket or your purse. There'll be other ways. You know, it'll be on a headset or glasses or on your wrist or something like that. You won't... You know, we're paying huge bucks for a technology that's probably not going to last more than a dozen years.
It is true, and it's going to be fun to watch it, really. I mean, I hope I'm around to watch a little bit of it here as it goes forward, because it's likely, to your point, in the next 10 years, there are going to be incredible things happen.
Speaking of which, are any of these autonomous car companies publicly traded, or are most of them... private operations that are starting as a spin-off from somewhere at CMU. You know, these things are they're popping up like crazy all over Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah, most of them are not, but you know, the new car companies you know, have been led by Tesla, so you know, that one kind of everybody knows about and it's publicly traded, but isn't that going to be interesting?
It's unbelievable. It's revolutionary.
You know, like I've said, and, you know, I've said I'm never driving an electric car. I like the sound of my engine. So, I'm going to drive. I'm like, well, but that's me. See, that's me. That's not my son. Now, my son's 31. I suspect he'll drive whatever he wants to drive. If he drives a car at all. I mean, last time I was talking to him, he lives in a very heavily populated area. He's thinking about getting rid of his car. He doesn't need it. If he needs to go someplace, he calls the Uber guy up, and he comes and picks him up. And people have already done a lot of things that you know about, like they don't have landlines anymore in their houses. People just have cell phones. When one of these days... You know, you're really going to feel comfortable doing that. I like to have a backup, so I always have one. But again, you know, so I know a lot of people who don't have anything but cell phones. And you know, the problem is, in my view, what if it goes down? And it goes down for a long time.
As it did in Puerto Rico, for example.
Yeah. Then you have issues. You know. Then you have issues. So. You know, you never know what's going to happen. But most people have said, you know what? I don't care. I think it's crazy to have another expense. You know, I'm not going to pay for a landline that nobody calls. You know, everybody calls my cell phone. You know, they don't call my landline, which is true, by the way. I mean, everybody calls my cell phone. Yeah. You know, very few people call my landline at home. Everybody just calls my cell phone.
We'll take a break. We're talking with Howie Penteny today on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR. Stick with us. We'll be back with more right after these words.
Well, the holidays are coming, and that means your office will start receiving tasteless tins of popcorn, boring baskets of fruit and nuts, and a plethora of 2018 calendars. Ugh. Give your clients something better, something memorable, and something that says Butler. Like a custom gift box from Cummings Candy and Coffee, you can choose from an assortment of chocolate-covered chips, pretzels, graham crackers, and cherry cordials. Add in a half-pound bag of Butler's own proprietary blend of coffee, the Main Street Roast. Call Barry for your corporate order. Cummings Candy and Coffee, serving the Butler community since 1905 and now in three locations. Looking for a way to make your company's benefit package a little more competitive? Here's one that's so easy, more than 130 local organizations and businesses have added it to their programs. Membership in Armco Credit Union. At Armco Credit Union, your employees will have access to the best loan rates and more free banking services, while direct deposit and payroll deduction options make it convenient for both of you. And best of all, it doesn't cost you a thing. Learn more at armcocu.com or by calling 284-2020. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is insured by NCUA.
Welcome back. It's the Monday edition. It's your turn here on WISR. We chat with Howie Penteny of Penteny Capital Management in Portersville, and we're talking about investments. How did they do during the first three quarters of 2017? We're down to 3 months, October, November, December. By the way, isn't October oft times a tradition or a history of movement on the stock market, the month
it
of
is.
October?
Yeah, it's not necessarily good or bad. A lot of people think it's bad. It's not
necessarily that's because
bad.
The big crash of 29 happened in October.
Yeah. Well, I think the reason we're starting, Dave, we've talked about this before, we're starting to enter a period of seasonal strength, which is what people call October, November, December, January, February, March. Actually, I think it skips February. But anyway, typically it's these 6 months in here someplace, which start someplace, that the markets typically are pretty strong. You know, everybody's back from vacation. And, you know, it just seems to work out that way, that this time of the year, going into January, February, you know, blah, 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 it's usually pretty strong.
Talk about the foreign markets.
Yeah. Very strong because they've been crappy. You know, those markets haven't done well over the past years. And this year, you know, generally speaking, I think the Dow Global Index, not including the United States, is up almost 19%. And some of the emerging markets, which are the smaller usually the smaller countries and the riskier situations, some of those markets are up 30. So the foreign markets have been stronger, I think, my opinion, because they've been weaker and because the stocks appear to be cheaper there. Now we'll find out as time goes along, but you know, it's I'm encouraged whenever I see that. I like it used to be easy to do things because it used to be that if you bought global stocks and if you bought stocks in the United States and you put them all together, your portfolio did better, okay? Inside the United States, outside the United States, overall portfolio better. Not necessarily true the past several years. This year, true. If you have a portfolio of some foreign investments and some domestic investments, your portfolio is probably doing okay. You know, and so that it used to be easy to do that, but things have really changed over the past 10 or so years.
Are there still a lot of Americans who invest in foreign markets?
Yeah, I think so.
Because Europe, for example, you know, they were much harder hit by the recession of 08, 09. Well, we were hard hit too, but we recovered much quicker. There are still European countries. Britain's a prime example. They haven't recovered yet. It's 10 years almost.
Generally speaking, investors, not including institutional investors, people who manage mutual funds, people who manage money, blah, 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 the investor doesn't buy anything that's not sold to him. So if his advisors are advising him to put some money outside the U.S., then they'll put some money outside the U.S. But I would venture to say that most people probably wouldn't bother with that if they didn't get some sort of a recommendation. And I like to have some money everywhere, so, you know, I agree with that.
Let's talk a little bit about some commodities. Energy is always at the top of everyone's list because it can be extremely volatile, and we've seen that during the past quarter. It was actually about a month ago when Hurricane Harvey hit the coast of Texas and Louisiana, Houston, and the other refineries there. And the next day, or so it seemed, I think it was the next day,
right,
gasoline was up 30 cents a gallon here in Butler.
Right.
I mean, that's volatility.
Yeah. And the crude oil's down almost 4% this year. And it's interesting. I've been watching this because it's interesting. I've noticed the oil stocks, to a large degree, are up. From where they were most recently. So even though crude's down, a lot of the oil stocks are up, which is kind of interesting. Sometimes the market anticipates. So maybe, who knows, maybe those markets are headed higher. You know, maybe the oil markets are headed higher. I don't know. I have no clue. But typically, the market's smarter than you and I. You know, the market's never wrong. It's you and I who are wrong. So sometimes the market anticipates, and sometimes it's right. Sometimes it's correct.
Any movement in the price of natural gas?
It's just been getting killed. You know,
it's very low.
Down. It's down almost 20% this year. Now, it's $3, and you know, I remember it being 12 or 13, if not higher. You know. So it's still quite depressed. And interestingly enough, they're still doing some drilling around here. Have you noticed?
And not only that, but they're building pipelines like crazy. I was driving out, where was I, one day last week? I remember now. I crossed the same pipeline twice.
Right.
It's the one that is coming across, across Sunset Drive. And then it goes further over to the west and crosses Benbrook Road. Oh, it also goes under 422. So there's three major roads in there. There were crews. I crossed it twice, Benbrook Road, Sunset Drive. Trucks, bulldozers, pipes going in, crews all over the place, guys in those fluorescent yellow T-shirts, building pipelines like crazy. They must be expecting that the price of gas, natural gas, is going to go up. They wouldn't be building all these pipelines.
And so you just got to figure to yourself, are these guys really dumb or do they know what's going on? See, and they, by the way, they don't know that prices are going up. But if you take an oil, we're not advocating that you buy this stock. I'm just giving it to you as an example. And I think that my numbers are pretty close. Exxon used to be the world's largest oil company. Now it's about 50% natural gas. So these guys are really, really either really dumb or they're really smart. And you can take sides and bet on who you want to.
I'm betting on it.
You figure, I mean, what's going to happen to gasoline prices if electric cars really catch on?
You're talking about gasoline for fueling cars.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. What if that works? Okay. There's going to be less of a demand. Here's the thing about natural gas that is kind of interesting, and that is that there are a lot of countries in this world of ours that have no natural resources. They don't have coal. They don't have oil. They don't have anything. And what can you ship around? You know, you can ship anything, but these big tankers that hold propane, I think people are figuring out that, you know, this is going to be a demand as the world continues to grow and expand and blah, 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 that people are going to need more natural gas for sure, according to some people. I mean, that's obviously what some of these major oil companies who have turned into major natural gas companies, that's obviously what they're betting.
And we're making, we're generating more electricity now by using natural gas. Instead of the coal-fired power plants, several of them have switched over to natural gas-powered electric generating stations.
a long time ago, I remember somebody said something, some writer said something that I just have always laughed about. And he said, you don't screw around with the oil companies, because they're gonna come and get you eventually. They know what they are doing. These are bright people who are looking. They're visionaries, Dave, if you mm-hmm. think about it, right? I mean, they're looking out 50 or 100 years. They're trying to figure out what's going on way out there. And people who do that for a living and are successful, those are the people that, you know, that mm-hmm. are really successful. And the oil companies have done a really good job of that in the past. So we don't know that it's going to work again, but it could.
Well, natural gas seems to be the future. We're always going to need electricity. How do we generate it? Nuclear seems to be in decline. Boy, Westinghouse took a big hit with those two construction projects down in the South, Georgia and South Carolina, being shut down. I guess one of them is picked up again. I'm not sure, but Westinghouse just laid off another 1,500 employees.
Dave, it's all about the money, you know? It's all about the money. Today, almost everything in the United States is all about the money. I don't care what you're looking at, whether you're looking at politics or whatever, it's all about the money. And the people who are trying to figure out where business should be, it's all about the money. Where are we going to, you know? Look at them. I was just by a few minutes ago, right down here from you, what used to be the Kmart Plaza, if mm-hmm. you will, okay? And you look at that thing, and it's almost sad, you know? It's almost sad if you go down there and look at it. And you know, it's almost empty. And so people who own these malls, what do you think they're doing? You think they're going to roll over and everything? No, they're trying to figure out how they're going to get people back into those malls. And I read something the other day that I had known a long time ago and just didn't realize it. There are people looking at making malls into places for people to live. For instance, let's assume, and I had a good friend of mine who lived in a very exclusive, for lack of a better word, condo complex or apartment complex. And Dave, this was a long time ago. I mean, I'm talking about 20 years ago. You didn't have to go out of the building. There was a dry cleaner in there. There was a grocery store in there. There was a barber in there. You did not have to go out of the building. Mm. Now, I've read where that, you know, think about it. A lot of malls, a lot of space. I mean, you could have apartments. You could have some food. You could have people living in these malls. And it isn't something that you and I couldn't see happening.
Fascinating. I haven't heard about that, but as soon as you talk about it.
Doesn't it make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's real estate. A, it's real estate. B, mm-hmm. people need places to live now, particularly people getting older. C, they don't want to walk up steps. There aren't any steps in most malls, okay? So theoretically, you could have a place that had a grocery store and a couple of restaurants in it, and you could, you know, you could have 100 condos in there, and bingo, all of a sudden it looks okay. So we don't know what's going to happen, although I think that's going to happen. I mean, I would venture to say that you're going to see that happening pretty soon.
I did read something about, I think the official name is Sears Holding Company, the parent of all the Sears stores, which have been closing willy-nilly. And they say that in many cases, not all, but in many cases, they own the property. They own the
big
stores.
Bucks. Yeah. Big bucks.
And that's what they're looking
and, at. And they're looking, well, you know, and everybody's trying today. I mean, I always talk about my son because he's 31 and he's one of these millennials, you know. And, you know, they're trying to figure out how they're going to get my son back into the malls. Because generally speaking, and this is not 100% true, but generally speaking, my son is not a Sears guy or a JCPenney guy. I'm sorry. He's not going to go into a mall and shop for those things like you and I did. Okay, he's going to go elsewhere, whether it's online or whether it's at the boutiques or what he's going to do. You know, he's not necessarily going to, and that's what these mall people are trying to figure out, Dave. I read all the time about these people, And they're all trying to figure out how are we going to get these younger people back into our real estate. And they've got to figure that out. And so far, they haven't figured it out.
Howie Penteny visiting with us. It's always great fun to chat with Howie. It's informative. It's educational. We do caution you again, and we told you at the beginning of the program, we're not giving any specific financial advice here on the program. For that sort of information, you should consult with your own wealth manager, financial advisor, tax consultant, attorney, whatever. Our purpose here is to inform and educate and maybe have a little fun, which we usually do. Right. We're talking with Howie Penteny from Penteny Capital Management in Portersville. Howie, good to see you, and we'll look forward to seeing you, I guess, after the first of the year.
Huh? And congratulations on your longevity.
Thank you. As Mark Twain said, considering the alternative, feels pretty good. Right. Thank you. Thanks, Holly. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Coming up, Matthew Kramer. He's the musical director and conductor of the Butler Symphony Orchestra, and they, believe it or not, are about ready to open up a new season this weekend, as a matter of fact. Well, what are they up to, 50-something? We'll ask Matthew. He'll be joining us next. On It's Your Turn on WISR, so please stick with us. We'll be back to talk with Matthew Kramer in just a couple of minutes.
Tanglewood, your hometown center for entertainment, presents an evening of comedy and mystery Saturday, October 21st with Dial M for Murder, presented by Pittsburgh acting group Mysteries Most Wanted. You may remember it as a crime mystery film directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Doors open at 5 o'clock. Buffet dinner by Chef George at 6, showtime at 7. Only $25 per person. As always, it's BYOB. Reserve your tickets for Dial M for Murder at Tanglewood Center, 287-0021.
Thompson Miller probably receives more calls about cremation than any other subject. So let me share with you what you need to know, what you need to think about concerning this sensitive subject. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler is often asked these points. Should you consider cremation for your loved one? Is it appropriate for your family? What's the appropriate funeral service? What's the cost? Good questions. Cremation offers three advantages: simplicity, convenience, and it's local. Thompson Miller's cremation services are right here in Butler at our own newly created facility. We assure you that your loved ones will never leave our care at any point in the process. Let's talk it over privately right here at Thompson Miller, or call us at 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or online at www.thompson-miller.com. Thompson Miller at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Welcome back, folks, to Monday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Dave Malarkey is my name, and our next guest is Matthew Kramer, the musical director and conductor of the Butler Symphony Orchestra. Good afternoon, Matthew. Good to talk with you again.
Great to be back with you, Dave.
Hard to believe that another season is upon us. I was talking earlier and promoting the fact that we were going to be chatting with you today, that we're most fortunate here in the Butler area to have several cultural groups for a community our size. Our theater groups are starting up again. And, of course, the Butler Symphony, what a treasure for a city our size. I dare say there are not too many communities who have our population that have a symphony of the quality of ours. And you would be able to make a judgment on that because you've conducted orchestras all over the country.
I could not agree with you more, Dave. And I know that being the music director of the orchestra, I'm intimately involved with the music making and the musicians. But again, your sentiment, I've echoed that every chance that I've gotten to be in front of an audience, that not only the caliber of the orchestra, but the support from the community. We have a number of our shows the past few seasons have sold out, and the intermediate high school seats 1,200, and cities with enormous populations don't fill up their orchestra halls with that kind of enthusiasm. So Butler really is a very special place. It's a terrific regional orchestra. The musicians, many of them from Western Pennsylvania, a few from Ohio, we all come together and we just enjoy making great music for our audiences.
And by the way, I'm glad that you mentioned that because there are a number of orchestras, and we're talking big-name orchestras that are having real trouble filling the seats these days, right?
That's an ongoing problem, really, for the arts. And it's just because there's so much competition these days for the entertainment dollar. You know, we are an art form, obviously, but at the same time, we live in the 21st century where we do compete for people's attention. And, you know, there's so much going on the weekend now. The, you know, we talk about a lot the subscription model isn't what it was in the 50s and 60s, where you could expect an audience to buy tickets for every one of your performances. Now we find that, especially with younger people, that they wait until Thursday or Friday to figure out what it is they want to do with the weekend. So we feel very strongly about the quality of product that we're putting out there. The musicians prepare very hard for you know, a high caliber performance. As far as the diversity in our programming, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about today into the course of the season. We have everything from Brahms, as we're opening up, to movie music and our traditional holiday program. So we're very cognizant of the fact that we need to provide something that everyone in the community will enjoy. And I think that that's, we've really seen that with the attendance at our orchestra concerts. And everybody in this industry, orchestras big and small, are trying to figure out a way to be relevant to their communities.
The new season of the Butler Symphony Orchestra opens this Saturday, folks, October 7th. And I would guess, and I know this isn't your particular bailiwick, Matthew, but my guess is since the season hasn't opened yet, you could probably still get a season subscription up until the weekend, I would imagine, huh?
That's absolutely right. And, of course, you can buy tickets individually for the programs that look most attractive to you. But we do really encourage everyone to take advantage of this great programming. Six concerts, and as you pointed out on numerous occasions, Dave, our board has done an incredible job over the years of keeping ticket prices so low that, you know, really they make great gifts for family members and friends, these subscriptions. But, of course, we would love to see everybody at all six of our concerts.
Ticket prices, listeners, just to back up what Matthew said, $23 for adults. And this is the one that is a real eye-opener, $5.50 for students and children, a great way to expose younger people to this music. And that $23 ticket, I want to tell you, if you start looking around at symphony concert tickets in other cities, wow, that's three, four times that easy. So anyway, you can check
On top of that, Dave, if I can interject, I'd just like to say that on top of that, you don't have to pay for parking either. If you head into Pittsburgh, you've got a world-class orchestra down there, but of course the drive, the parking, you can hear great performances without having to pay for any of that, and it's in your backyard.
Yes, at the I'm assuming you're at the same venue, Butler Intermediate High School Auditorium again, Matthew?
And that's been our home for many years. Yeah, very comfortable space for us.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, a wonderful performing space, too. That school now is, oh gosh, must be at least 30 years old, maybe even more. But the acoustics in that auditorium remain top-notch. In fact, from the time it opened, it's had incredible acoustics, especially for music. Yeah, great stuff.
Absolutely.
The I'm kind of laughing at myself because earlier I told people you were going to be on with us today, and I said, let's see, what year is it for the Butler Symphony? I think it's at least 50. it's the 69th, for goodness sakes, the 69th season that opens this Saturday. So the Butler Symphony has been around for a long, long time. I want to briefly mention the program for the season because I think the theme is worlds apart. But the opening concert this coming Saturday night, Matthew, is, as my understanding at least, all the pieces are by the same composer. Is that right?
That's right. There aren't too many composers that we have in the repertoire that you can really dedicate an entire concert to just because of, you know, the sake of diversity or, you know, whether the composer's music really merits an entire evening performance. And, of course, we can do that with Mozart. We can do that with Beethoven. Tchaikovsky is a very popular composer because everybody recognizes his glorious melodies. But you know, another composer that really merits this kind of attention and this kind of program is Johannes Brahms, the great German composer from the mid-19th century, really the heir to Beethoven. And the reason for this is that many musicians over the course of my 5 years with the orchestra had been asking, when are we going to play Brahms? When are we going to play a symphony? And I actually look back into the orchestra's programming, and it's been since 1982, I believe, that the orchestra has played this Brahms symphony, the great, majestic second symphony that we're going to be playing. So obviously over 30 years, it was time to pull this work out. And we have this incredible connection with a violinist who probably needs no introduction to Western Pennsylvania audiences, Andreas Cardenas, who was the longtime concertmaster of the Pittsburgh Symphony, is now the director of orchestra studies at Carnegie Mellon, and so many of his violin students play in the Butler County Symphony, or have over the course of the last 5 years. So he'll be joining the principal cellist of my orchestra in Indianapolis, the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra, Marjorie Hanna, to play the great Brahms double concerto for violin and cello. So that really kind of finished the programming right there, just knowing that the symphony, which is so incredible, hadn't been played in years, and then this double concerto with Andres and Marjorie, you know, that's really an evening of extraordinary music right there.
Andre is, and I'm not really familiar with him, but he's from Cuba, is he not?
That's right. He's got obviously been in the country for many years, especially with the Pittsburgh Symphony. But yes, he's does have Cuban ancestry and just a marvelous violinist. Actually, the story is with him and Marjorie that they met in their student days at Indiana University. So. It's great for them to be able to reunite and to play this great concerto together.
Marjorie is a, well, I say her principal instrument is a cello. I'm sure at her level she probably plays about 15 different stringed instruments, but she's the principal cellist for the Indiana Chamber Orchestra. I have fallen in love with the sound of the cello over the past 10 or 15 years. By the way, Matthew, and I say this because if there are people listening who, I don't know, maybe they've never been to a Butler Symphony concert or haven't been to very many, and they say, well, I don't know a whole lot about classical music. I don't know a whole lot about Brahms. Folks, don't be intimidated by that. Don't be embarrassed. I'm not embarrassed at all to say that I'm learning a lot about classical music, especially over the last 15 years or so. But one of the reasons why I fell in love with the cello is because of Yo-Yo Ma. I saw him on TV a couple of times just by himself. I said, my gosh, what an instrument. Well, what an artist, of course, but I just love the sound of a cello. I assume I'm not alone.
No, that sentiment is shared by many, many people. And the reason is that the cello has extraordinary range. These are all basically the same instrument, the violin, the viola, the cello. They're just in bigger form. So a cello is just, that's why the formal name for the cello is the violoncello in Italian. Mm. And it's just the same shape, the same measurements, really, of the violin, just expanded to a much larger form. And the great thing about the cello, like I mentioned, is this incredible range from the lowest note, the open C string, to the upper echelon of its register. It's just got an incredible sonority. And in many ways, the string instrument's most closely related to the human voice, too. It's just a very poetic, exquisite instrument. And like you mentioned, with Yo-Yo Ma, he just introduced countless people, especially in this country, to the instrument, to the great repertoire, and a lot of different things. He experiments with folk music and world music as well. And one little anecdote to share, that we are borrowing the Pittsburgh Symphony's cello podium for this. When a cello solos with an orchestra, they can't just sit on the stage. They have to be elevated. So the Pittsburgh Symphony has this great cello box that Marjorie will be sitting on, and that's the same cello box that Yo-Yo Ma sits on every time that he solos with the Pittsburgh Symphony.
Wow, that would be a thrill. Wow. We're talking about the concert this Saturday night, folks, which is October 7th, believe it or not, and it's the opening concert of the 69th season of the Butler Symphony, featuring, as musical director and conductor Matthew Kramer said, Andres Cardenas, violin, and Marjorie Hanna, cello. Now, will they perform the, that's the double concerto, obviously, the Brahms double concerto that he wrote specifically for violin and cello, right?
That's right. It's actually his last symphonic work, written in 1887. He was already approaching the end of his life. He only had 10 years left to live, and the remaining years he composed a lot of smaller works for piano and for clarinet, chamber music. So this is really his last full-scale orchestral work, and it really is magnificent the way that both solo instruments are utilized, their interaction with one another, and the orchestra's role in this. It's a very complex piece. It doesn't necessarily sound like that from the audience perspective, but the nuance and the inner voice themes, how it all comes together, it really is a sign of a composer who had complete mastery of his craft by this point. So really an important work in the Brahms echelon, the Brahms catalog of music.
Tell us a little bit about Johannes Brahms. You mentioned that he was German. I know that he was born and died in the 1800s. The thing that I remember from my music appreciation, it's funny the things that stick with you for decades. My music appreciation class, what the instructor called the three B's of classical composers. It was Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms. I assume that there are other people that were taught the three B's as well.
No, that's absolutely right, and that's stuck. That stayed with the course of time. Of course, we'd love to be able to slide an M in there with Mozart or a V with Verdi, but the three B's is a very catchy way of remembering three of the most important composers we have. And the reason that Brahms is lumped in there is not just because of the fact that his last name shares the first letter. It's because he's the heir, really, to that tradition. As I mentioned earlier, when Beethoven died, he had completed these groundbreaking works, the Ninth Symphony, for example. And music history started to move away from this kind of composition. A lot of it became very programmatic. Composers like Wagner and Schumann and Berlioz were trying to tell stories with their music. It had a programmatic meaning to it. And Brahms was very much a conservative in the sense that he was very tied to the traditions of the past. He wrote symphonies, not operas. His music didn't have extra musical meaning. It was just music written for music's sake. And so really what that turned into in the mid-19th century was a battle between two schools, between people who supported Wagner and his turning music, really into the dense chromatic harmonies and these programmatic, very dramatic stories that he was telling with his operas, and Brahms, who was just plowing ahead, showing that you could still write a symphony, you could still write a concerto, and it wasn't archaic anymore. So really, these two schools, it's just fascinating to see that Wagner had all of these people that were following him, and Brahms had very few composer disciples. There weren't really many composers who followed Brahms, the sole exception really being Antonín Dvořák. But other than that, Brahms wrote all this great music, and he was really kind of on an island in many respects. So it didn't take very long for everyone to appreciate his greatness. He was a success story in his 30s and remains so. He's one of the most important composers of the time. But looking back at the music history element, it really is fascinating to see this kind of battle of turf in the 19th century.
Did any of these guys, did they know each other? Did they ever meet each other? I mean, even in this day of primitive travel, maybe early train travel, horse and carriage, they were all fairly concentrated. Germany, Austria, even Tchaikovsky in Russia. I mean, it's conceivable that they could meet each other every once in a while, or did they? Did they not converse at all?
No, they absolutely did, and you hit on something great. My favorite thing are these musical anecdotes, these stories. And Brahms, maybe one of the reasons he didn't have so many followers or disciples is because he was a very kind of spiteful man. He had a wicked tongue, and he ran into all of these composers. There's a well-documented interaction with him and Tchaikovsky. They both loathed each other and wrote in their journals how much they despised each other's music. One of the great stories is another German composer named Max Bruch, who wrote a famous violin concerto that we played at the Butler Symphony just within the last 2 years. Max Bruch showed Brahms his latest work, this massive symphonic work, and wanted Brahms's input, hopefully his support for it. And Brahms just leafed through the pages and after about 15 minutes just said, where did you get such magnificent paper? Was the best thing that he could come up about this massive symphony. So Brahms played jokes on his friends. He, would saw off, the stories go, saw off the legs of rocking chairs, and if somebody sat down, the chair would fall over. So they all knew each other pretty well. And again, Brahms didn't have much to say about anybody that was good, with the exception of Dvorak. And Brahms was really responsible for making Dvorak's career, and that's not hyperbole. Brahms introduced Dvorak to his publisher, got him a number of commissions to start his career off. So he was capable of doing good things, but like I said, he didn't have much good to say about almost everybody else.
The program for this Saturday night's opening concert of the new season of the Butler Symphony is all Brahms. Matthew mentioned the double concerto for violin and cello featuring the guest artists. Also, Symphony Number 2. Did Brahms write many symphonies, Matthew? Was he pretty prolific in this particular genre?
Only four, and this is interesting because this is one of the most well-known facts about Brahms, is that he did feel the shadow of Beethoven weighing on him, really kind of looming over him. So whereas Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn were all writing symphonies when they were still very young, especially for Mozart, Brahms waited until he was in his 40s, 44 years old, before he wrote his first symphony. And it's not that he didn't try. He destroyed a number of copies of works. He just felt like he couldn't. He wasn't mature enough, honestly, to write a symphony, especially with Beethoven. It was, he called it the tramps or the stomps of Haydn behind him. Mm. So when he did complete his first symphony in C minor, 1876, I believe, it was a long affair. It really took him about 10 years to complete it. And then, because he did it and it was such a success, almost with no effort whatsoever, he wrote his second symphony in less than a year. So the first symphony was premiered in 1876. The second was written and premiered in 1877. And it couldn't be any different than the first symphony. It's in D major. It's a bright, very sunny work. It has incredible melodies, including one very similar in the first movement to a melody everybody would recognize. Brahms, if you're thinking, do I know anything by Brahms? Of course you do, because he wrote the famous lullaby that many of us sing to our children every night before we put them to bed, the Brahms lullaby, of course. And there's a melody in the first movement that sounds very similar to that, except it's in minor, and Brahms, with this kind of dark humor, told his publisher that it's a bedtime lullaby for bad or sick children. So he had a very wicked, nasty wit to him. But this work, again, is a very sunny, very, very brilliant work, which couldn't be any different than his first symphony. But four symphonies in total, and two overtures and a couple other works as well.
So a couple of concertos, but symphonies, that would be the major work. I mean, they're all major works, but symphonies are the longest, right? Hardest to write.
Absolutely right. And traditionally in four movements, and as I mentioned earlier, Brahms was a traditionalist. He did some things that were not traditional. He replaced the third movement with an intermezzo, something that's much more light in character as opposed to the scherzo that Beethoven wrote. But by and large, Brahms didn't upset the musical world too much like Beethoven did, for example. He didn't use a chorus in his symphonies. And didn't, they're about the same length, really, as the Beethoven symphonies, right about 44 or 45 minutes. But they are very difficult to write, and it hasn't changed in 200 years since Mozart was writing them to, now when composers who are still writing symphonies. It's the most elevated intellectual musical form that we have.
I had a couple more questions for Matthew. Matthew, you can stick with us for a couple of minutes. I got to squeeze a break in here. Is that okay with you?
Absolutely, Dave.
Okay, a couple of more questions when we come back for Matthew Kramer, the musical director and conductor of the Butler Symphony. They open the new season this Saturday night at Butler Intermediate High School Auditorium. We'll be right back.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 8686. The pick 3, 778-778. Pick 4 is 2397. The pick 5, 24828. The wild ball for each of those is 2. The treasure hunt, 12, 13, 16, 25, and 26. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $30,000.
When is the best time to talk to your family about staying in touch during a disaster? When floodwaters reach your door? When wildfires are engulfing the edge of your neighborhood? Or an earthquake is destroying buildings? When a tornado is tearing through town? Or a hurricane strikes? Or is the best time, perhaps, today? During a disaster, you may not be able to stay in touch with your family or friends as easily as you think. And it's not always as simple as using your cell phone. That's why now is the time to take action. Go to ready.gov/communicate and make your emergency plan today. Don't wait. Communicate. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Listeners, we're wrapping up our conversation with Matthew Kramer, the musical director and conductor of the Butler Symphony, which opens its 69th season this Saturday night. A couple of questions, Matthew. First of all, Brahms, the German composer, lived in the 1800s, the 19th century. Were the instruments in a symphony orchestra at that time pretty much the same as today, or have they changed over that period?
Brahms, especially in the mid-1800s, didn't do much in the way of the symphony to change instruments. And Beethoven, of course, did. He's the one that introduced the trombones to the symphony, added some horns, added the piccolo, added the contrabassoon. But Brahms didn't add anything additional. Wagner, for example, did. He couldn't find the right instrument that was in his mind, so he created one, and we call it the Wagner tuba. It's a mixture of a French horn and a tuba. And most of the instruments had already been established by the 19th century, and only a few things really have changed then. The piano is now a member of the orchestra, and is featured in a lot of 20th century music. Occasionally, you'll have the saxophone come into the orchestra, but that's more like a friend that we invite to play with us every once in a while. It's not a real family member because most of the music doesn't use saxophone. And I think the biggest thing that an audience member would see in the change in the orchestra comes in the percussion section, because in Brahms' day, you really only had the timpani back there, maybe a bass drum, maybe some cymbals, depending on what the repertoire, but really in the 20th century is where the percussion section has just really exploded with possibilities. So basically anything that you can hit or smash is now a percussion instrument. So, you know, Gershwin, American in Paris, which we played last season, you know, the sounds of those taxi Claxton horns, that's a member of the percussion section. Yeah. But by and large, the Brahms, you'll see the oboe, you know, the violin, all of those instruments represented, just like they had been in Beethoven and Mozart's time as well.
One final question. So many of the classical composers composed a mass. Some of them did more than one. Did Brahms ever compose a mass? Did he do a Dies Irae, Dies Irae?
Oh, one of the best ones, in all honesty. He wrote a requiem, and it's called the German Requiem. And it's really, and many people think, a mass for the living Brahms. Wouldn't say he was necessarily agnostic, but he didn't wear his faith as firmly as Mozart or Haydn did. Certainly the times were much different. So his mass, his requiem mass, is really much different in tone. But it is a beautiful, beautiful work, and one that is in the repertoire and has been since it was first written. Very, very popular. And in addition to that, Brahms wrote a number of other large-scale choral works for orchestra and chorus. But the German Requiem is really one for any of your listeners to take a listen to. It is really exalting life, and it's just full of warmth and beauty.
Sometimes when an Irishman gets to talking, he talks too long, Matthew. I talked too long about Brahms. I didn't get a chance to talk about some of the upcoming concerts. Well, we'll have plenty of time to do that throughout the season. We look forward to opening night of the Butler Symphony this Saturday. Check with the symphony office on the Diamond or online for ticket information. Matthew Kramer, thanks for being with us. Good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Sure, sure. So long now. Matthew Kramer. Symphony's fortunate to have him. Yeah. Let me see. Coming up on tomorrow's program, gosh, give me a second here to get to my schedule. I still had some information on my screen there about our conversation with Howie. And we thank Howie Petney for being with us earlier on the program today. Always fun to talk with him. And certainly Matthew Kramer. Matthew's so knowledgeable. By the way, again, if you're a little bit leery about how much you know or don't know about classical music, Matthew, most concerts, and I know he's doing it for this one, he gives a little pre-concert lecture to kind of tell you what's coming up. Usually he has some of the musicians on stage to give you a little preview of the music so you can better understand it. Coming up on tomorrow's program, among our guests, Stan Kosciuszko will be with us tomorrow. Good to see Stan. And we're also going to be talking tomorrow with two young ladies. We've chatted with them before, Kirsten and Kiara Wood. They're organizing their annual fundraiser for awareness of Huntington's disease. So we'll talk with those young ladies tomorrow. We'll have some other stuff for you as well on the program tomorrow. Is it tomorrow that we have the gentleman from Jerusalem? I believe so, yes. Elon Greenfield with us on tomorrow's program. We've also got lots of stuff on the Tuesday edition of It's Your Turn. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. I'm Dave Malarkey, and we'll see you tomorrow, 12:30, here on It's Your Turn on WISR 680 in Butler.